and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We will begin with boasts on 60 Minutes from the leader of the Arizona chapter of the Oath Keepers, the biggest of the nationwide militia among the far-right groups who stormed the Capitol, that many active duty military and police are in their ranks and that they get training from serving police officers. Joining us is Vita Johnson, a criminal defense attorney and professor of law at Georgetown University Law Center, who works in the Criminal Defense and Prisoner Advocacy Clinic and Criminal Justice Clinic, and authored a paper in 2019 that included a list of more than 100 police departments in 49 states that have faced scandals over racist threats, emails, or public social media posts by officers since 2009. We'll examine the need for federal standards in the recruitment of police officers to exclude racist sympathizers of white supremacist groups like the Oath Keepers, and the case of a police officer in Arkansas who admitted on his application form that he had attended a KKK rally as a young man who later went on to shoot dead an unarmed black boy. Then we'll look further into the Oath Keepers and their role in storming the Capitol on January the 6th, now that one of the leaders of that assault has flipped and is now cooperating with FBI investigations into the riot and the rioters. Brian Levin, a criminologist, civil rights attorney, professor of criminal justice, and director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University San Bernardino, joins us to discuss the split within the Oath Keepers between the far-right insurrectionists and the ultra-far-right domestic terrorists. Then finally, after having interviewed a sympathizer of the government of Ethiopia, we are joined by Ambassador Fesaha Tesema, a Tigrayan career diplomat who previously served as Ethiopia's ambassador to the United Nations as well as ambassador to Israel. He joins us to discuss the paralysis at the United Nations, where China and Russia have been blocking efforts to stop the slaughter of civilians and get humanitarian aid into a country that appears to be breaking apart. And before we begin, as the toxic cloud of the tragic Trump years lifts and we gear up to rebuild our broken country and heal our endangered world, we at Background Briefing will soon have to rely on your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep broadcasting on affiliates and online at backgroundbriefing.org, as either the Pacifica network goes bankrupt or the dysfunctional and destructive Pacifica boards take Background Briefing off the air in retaliation for my advocacy for professional management and financial transparency. When we move fully to online broadcasting, we will be depending on you, our growing global and national community of listeners, to sustain us for as little as $5 a month to keep this program independent, corporate-free, and accessible to those not in a position to contribute at backgroundbriefing.org/donate. And I thank you for your support. And joining us now is Vita Johnson, who is a criminal defense attorney and associate professor of law at Georgetown University Law Center. She works in the Criminal Defense and Prisoner Advocacy Clinic and the Criminal Justice Clinic, and she authored a paper in 2019 that included a list of more than 100 police departments in 49 states that have faced scandals over racist text, emails, or public social media posts by officers since 2009. Welcome to Background Briefing, Vita Johnson.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us. And 60 Minutes on Sunday night had a segment on the Oath Keepers, and it appears that there's a split in the movement between the person who founded it, Stuart Rhodes, who's apparently gone quite radical and was involved and present at the January 6th storming of the Capitol. They interviewed the head of the Arizona chapter, which is the biggest chapter of the Oath Keepers. And in that interview, he bragged about the fact that his organization has a lot of active duty military and active duty police within their ranks, and that the police and the military train the Oath Keepers to be more professional, if one can use that description. So the work that you've done seems to dovetail in the sense that it's not much of a stretch to assume that somebody within a police force who's tweeting out racist comments might be susceptible to joining militias that attract white supremacists.
Yes, you know, I do think that far-right extremism in policing, unfortunately, is a serious problem in the United States.
And what do you think can be done in terms of what you wrote in your paper in 2019, the idea that there ought to be some kind of regime to make it clear who these people are in within police forces? Because if a racist policeman ends up being either a defendant or a witness in a court case, that is relevant information.
Absolutely. I think that this should be something that police departments and city governments and local legislatures take very seriously. I think there are a number of steps that could be taken to try to root out these far-right extremists on police departments. I think police should have their social media accounts monitored. This could be easily done in terms of agreements at hiring and as a condition of employment that social media checks be done by the police department. I think it's very easy for police departments to monitor work emails and work texts, and there are algorithms that would allow them to search for certain words associated with far-right extremism and white supremacy. This is something that we know police have the ability to do because they do it when they're monitoring other groups in their police work. So they certainly should be doing it with respect to their officers. I also think that prosecutors should be playing a role in trying to identify police officers that hold anti-government and white supremacist views, because, you know, those sorts of things don't belong on police departments. In this article that I wrote in 2019 called KKK and the PD, one of the suggestions that I propose is that prosecutors look for this information and turn it over to the defense for use at trial in criminal cases. Once an officer is exposed as holding some sort of bias outside of the mainstream, they no longer become usable to the police department, right? Once someone is someone that they can't sponsor as a witness or has lost their credibility, they end up not having public-facing roles within the department, right? So let's say, for example, an officer had used the N-word in an investigative stop with a civilian. Once that becomes known, you know, the police department is not going to be able to use that officer in a role with the public. So maybe that officer gets fired, or maybe more likely ends up in a desk job, guarding evidence, something like that. But in any event, that would make us much safer if that person is no longer using force to enforce the laws. And that's the thing that's very scary about these police officers. They hold a tremendous amount of discretion, a tremendous amount of power, and they're armed. So it's a pretty terrifying combination.
Well, of course, in the O.J. Simpson trial, the defense were able to attack one of the police officers involved, Mark Furman, by suggesting he was a racist.
Absolutely, and that's one of the examples I use in my article, that how effective of a tool that can be. The fact that he had used the N-word ended up calling his credibility into question, and ended up ultimately being one of the reasons that the jury voted to acquit in that case. So we see that using handing over this type of information, which we call Brady information. It's a Supreme Court case called Brady versus Maryland that requires the government to turn over exculpatory information to the defense. And so prosecutors under the Brady Doctrine are supposed to turn over anything that's favorable to the defense or that impeaches the witness's credibility. And so that's a great example of how racial animus impeach the credibility of Detective Furman.
And again, I'm speaking with Vida Johnson, who's a criminal defense attorney and associate professor of law at Georgetown University Law Center. She works in the Criminal Defense and Prisoner Advocacy Clinic and the Criminal Justice Clinic, and she authored a paper in 2019 that included a list of more than 100 police departments in 49 states that have faced scandals over racist texts, emails, or public social media posts by officers since 2009. So, of course, there are attacks on the right against anything along the lines of what we're discussing here, Vida, particularly this notion of cancel culture, that this is a First Amendment issue, that people on the right are entitled to have these kind of beliefs. So how do you deal with that?
Oh, that's a great question. It's clear that you can hold these types of beliefs. That's absolutely protected by our First Amendment. But the First Amendment doesn't guarantee you a right to a job as a police officer. And so if you want to hold those types of beliefs, that's fine, but you shouldn't have a job as a public servant in the United States. And that goes for whether you hold explicitly racist views or you're a member of a group like the Oath Keepers. The Oath Keepers are an anti-government extremist organization. How it would even be within the realm of what is defensible to have someone who is an oath keeper who's on a police department where their job is to enforce the laws, yet your position is that the government should be attacked, and it is, you know, it's just so far from anything that I think is mainstream. I don't think anyone who's very serious would make that type of argument. Though I will say there have been examples of police officers who have been identified who are members of the Oath Keepers and similar groups like the Three Percenters. But I don't think there is a very serious First Amendment concern. There is a Second Circuit case that dealt with this that made it very clear that a police officer's First Amendment rights don't trump a police department's right to have a police department reflect the values of the community that they're supposed to be protecting. So I don't think that's a very serious argument.
Well, it wasn't so long ago in this country, Vida Johnson, where people were routinely asked whether they were applying for a job at a local municipality or a state government or a federal government. You know, did you belong, for example, to the Communist Party? So what kind of barriers or what kind of questions are asked when police are recruited? Are they asked about what kind of organizations they belong to?
It really depends. One of the interesting issues about the United States is that our policing systems are so varied, you know, state by state and even city by city. And so some police departments have very thorough background checks and others don't. There is a kind of a terrifying story of a police officer in Little Rock, Arkansas, who was asked as part of a background check, had he ever been a member of a hate group? And he was honest and said that he had attended a KKK meeting when he was a teenager. And he disclosed it and he was honest about it. And they said, okay, no problem. And they hired him. And, you know, that sort of thing, I find very troubling. My concerns about that were only, the only reason I know about this story is that that officer unfortunately went on to kill an unarmed Black child. And it was through the civil litigation that it became known that he had made this disclosure, and the police department hired him anyway. So it really doesn't matter what kind of background checks you have if the people who are implementing them don't see membership in hate groups as a problem. So I think, you know, we've got a lot of very serious problems in policing where, you know, even a question about whether you've attended a KKK rally doesn't keep you from joining a force.
So is there anything that the federal government can do in setting up guidelines or even laws here?
Well, that's an interesting question. I've proposed a federal licensing requirement, allowing a system that the federal government sets up that state and local police departments could opt into, where the federal program would allow for some training and background checks as part of the licensing program. And so when an officer does something and that would violate the strictures of the licensing program, they would lose their license and not be able to simply become a police officer in another jurisdiction, which is what happens, unfortunately, so often here in the United States. They can just go to the neighboring county and get hired there. So this is, it's just something, worth exploring in my mind. I'm not a constitutional law scholar. I do think that there are, some things worth thinking about how to get some federal control over this. But at the moment, the way our police departments operate in the United States, it's really just city by city.
Well, one of the things about the police departments across the country that I find interesting, and in particular when you contrast the salaries that police get, say, to the salaries that teachers get, police by and large are very well paid, certainly compared to teachers, and teachers have to have qualifications, and I'm not sure that there is the same requirements in terms of police professionalism. Is it, how do you see that as a, I was going to say an industry, of course it's not an industry, I don't know what you describe policing as, but within the policing world, do they have standards, and do these standards justify the kind of salaries? Because in New York, the salaries are up to $100,000 as they are here in Los Angeles for police officers.
No, absolutely. I mean, police officers can easily make six figures in a lot of cities. You know, it is a dangerous job. And I will say, I think, most police officers get into the work for the right reasons. But I think you're absolutely right that, it doesn't require the same amount of education as many other public servants have to possess in order to have and keep their jobs. So I think, there aren't universal standards, and there should be. That's one of the reasons that I proposed a federal licensing program, so that we can, as a community, decide what we want out of police officers and what kinds of, what sort of standards we want for police officers, because I think most Americans right now would agree that they're not meeting the standards we'd expect.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, Evita Johnson, we're all, of course, waiting for the verdict in the killing of George Floyd by Derek Chauvin, who's been on trial in Minneapolis. And in many ways, that seems to be putting policing on trial. Most of the testimony, particularly from police officers, were against him, including his bosses. And the assumption is that he's sort of a bad apple. So how do you think this is playing out in terms of police professionalism? Is this something that police departments around the country are looking at and realizing that if you get somebody like a Derek Chauvin in your ranks, you can end up having to pay the victims $27 million, which is a lot of money?
Well, unfortunately, that hasn't been a deterrent for police officers for quite some time. I mean, there have been federal lawsuits in lots of places that have amounted to millions. And in some cases, I believe Chicago has paid out more than $100 million to settle lawsuits against police. So I don't, unfortunately, think that that's a disincentive for extreme behavior by police. We also know the New York Times had some reporting yesterday that just in the days that this trial has been ongoing, police have murdered 60 plus people in the United States. In the 20 days of this trial, I might be getting the number wrong, but I think it was 64 people have been murdered by police. So unfortunately, I think the system is very broken. Or as some people say, it's working the way it was designed. But I think it's something that's very troubling to most Americans.
And of course, the shooting of Adam Toledo in Chicago by a police officer is now getting a lot of national attention. And obviously, the police department and the mayor of Chicago are on the hot seat.
As they should be. I think just as troubling as the shooting was the willingness of so many people to lie and say that he had that he was armed at the time, at the moment he was shot, despite there being video evidence to the contrary. So it's a system that it really needs a lot of work.
Well, I thank you for joining us, and I guess maybe some of these trials that are taking place with the Oath Keepers, and particularly the founder who was at on January the 6th, I don't think he's been charged, actually, but a number of the Oath Keepers have been charged. So perhaps that will do some good, do you think, just in closing?
Well, I certainly think that that federal prosecutors should be looking at these groups very carefully.
Well, Vita Johnson, I thank you for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Vita Johnson, who's a criminal defense attorney and associate professor of law at Georgetown University Law Center. She works in the Criminal Defense and Prisoner Advocacy Clinic and the Criminal Justice Clinic, and has authored a paper in 2019 that included a list of more than 100 police departments in 49 states that have faced scandals over racist text, emails, or public social media posts by officers since 2009. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the Oath Keepers and their role in storming the Capitol on January the 6th. She went away for the holiday, says she's going to LA, but she never got there, she never got there, she never got there, they say, yeah. The KKK took my baby away, took her away, away from it. The KKK took my baby away. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Brian Levin, a criminologist, civil rights attorney, professor of criminal justice, and director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University, San Bernardino, where he specializes in analysis of hate crimes, terrorism, and legal issues. He was previously Professor Levin served as associate director of the legal affairs of the Southern Poverty Law Center's Klan Watch Militia Task Force in Montgomery, Alabama, and he's testified before Congress's Homeland Security Subcommittee on Counterterrorism and Intelligence. Welcome to Background Briefing, Brian Levin.
Thank you, Ian, so much for having me on again. Always a pleasure.
Well, thanks, Brian. And you also were a police officer in New York City. So what did you make of the 60 Minutes interview with the Oath Keepers, particularly the chapter head of the Arizona chapter of the Oath Keepers, which is the largest one? They've apparently split off from the founder, Stuart Rhodes. But in the course of this interview, the head of the Arizona chapter of the Oath Keepers said that they have many active duty military and active duty police within their ranks, and that police and military professionals train them to be more professional. So what did you make of what this fellow had to say?
You know, it's like having a general practitioner come into you're a general practitioner and a patient comes into your office with all these symptoms and you go like, oh my gosh, a couple of things. First of all, I think most of the folks that are associated with them are retired. At least in a lot of major departments today, that's not going to get you far. But look at the controversy we had here in California, in Fresno, for instance. So some departments are lenient about this stuff and others aren't. But the bottom line is, this is a militia group. It was founded in 2009 by Stuart Rhodes, a Yale law grad, interestingly enough. But when they say that they have law enforcement training them, even if there's some hyperbole to that, and even if it's not done consistently, that is something that warrants investigation. By the way, let me just say something. These folks exaggerate a lot. I never take anything they say at face value. Two things. I think they always exaggerate what their relationship is with law enforcement, and I also think they generally exaggerate their numbers. That being said, here in California, for instance, there's legislation being proposed to try and weed out these kinds of folks during the application process. Moreover, one quick thing that's not a non sequitur, bear with me, and that is, under federal law, and it must be changed, if you are a trainer but not a trainee in paramilitary tactics to foment a civil disorder, you get the ability to be prosecuted, but not if you're a trainee. This is all problematic, and I do think, though, the Oath Keepers, in closing on this question, is a broad organization. I encountered them on various occasions. I found that they tried to kind of cooperate more with law enforcement at conflictual rallies during times when other folks like Ram or the Proud Boys would act more violent. But I think it varies by chapter. And let's look at the Ohio folks, for instance, who are really showing up in the insurrection charges. We have about a dozen Oath Keepers or more that have been charged with the more serious accounts. We have about 400 almost that have been charged so far overall. But last point, if I was an Oath Keeper, I might want to be quiet these days, because one of the co-founders just entered into a plea deal with the feds on Friday. Well, it was announced on Friday. I believe it was earlier in the year. And he's going to be singing like a canary. There's a lot of criminal liability and civil culpability for folks who may be tied to that organization.
Well, we know from the 60 Minutes piece, Brian, that these Oath Keepers that belong to the Ohio chapter, led by a woman, Jessica Watkins, a 36-year-old Army veteran, she was in that so-called stack where they were in full military outfits and in a line storming into the Capitol. So they used Zello transmissions, all of which were captured, or most of which were captured, by a New York WNYC radio reporter, Mika Loewinger. So the evidence is pretty extraordinary, where they're talking amongst themselves as they storm the Capitol. So what was the position, though, of Stuart Rhodes, the founder? He founded the group during the Obama administration, in fact, as a response to having our first black president.
Yep.
He says he's a constitutionalist. He founded the group at this sort of Revolutionary War site in Lexington, Massachusetts. So he was at the storming of the Capitol on January the 6th, was he not?
Yes, but he was allegedly outside. But it appears that the Rhodes was in communication. And I think you made an excellent point, if I could just say something. You know, I look back at something I wrote 11 years ago about failure to accept elections and extremism and this kind of revolt, this insurrectionist movement. When he says constitutionalist, this is someone who believes that when the government, in his subjective view and that of his fellow travelers, are acting tyrannical, under the Second Amendment, they have a right to armed rebellion. I wrote about this in The Limits of Dissent. So here's the problem. We now have grievance being a routinized fad almost here in the United States, particularly in the COVID era, right? So now we have folks like him spreading the notion that if you're upset, that's tyrannical, and you can launch armed rebellion. Let me tell you something. This guy Rhodes, he's got a bullseye on his back, and he was part of the same kind of tidal wave of change that came to the far right-wing extremist world in 2009 in the response to Obama getting elected. Let me make two points. A couple of things happened. First, we saw empirically threats against President Obama during the time that he was running, in other words, into the run-up of his election, were about four times what they were for Bush. We also saw hate crimes peak during that time in October and May, when it looked like Obama was going to win. So we see this response to change. Listen to what Tucker Carlson the other day said about responding to this change. What they mean is racial change, right? So bear with me. Around the same time, Spencer, who started his little Nazi slinging group, tried to enter into the political mainstream. So people like Spencer with his group, as well as the Oath Keepers, really entered into the mainstream. And now what we have is an elastic, grievance-oriented umbrella of which some of these cherries fall into groups like the one founded by Spencer, which is not a militia, but he was one that wanted to mainstream politically the whole message of white nationalism. And Rhodes is someone who hooked in with respect to insurrectionism, two distinct, though often intertwined, far-right ideologies, which have now been mainstreamed.
And again, I'm speaking with Brian Levin, a criminologist, civil rights attorney, professor of criminal justice, and director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University, San Bernardino, where he specializes in analysis of hate crime, terrorism, and legal issues. And previously, Professor Levin served as associate director of legal affairs of the Southern Poverty Law Center's Klan Watch Militia Task Force in Montgomery, Alabama. And he's testified before Congress's Homeland Security Subcommittee on Counterterrorism and Intelligence. You mentioned earlier, Brian, that one of the Oath Keepers who stormed the Capitol, I guess the leader, I mean, Jessica Watkins, of course, has also been charged, but he's now apparently cooperating with prosecutors. What is the role of Stuart Rhodes? And they, along with the Proud Boys, protected the guy that Trump pardoned, Roger Stone, who I believe the feds are also looking at. The IRS is also looking at him for failure to pay back taxes. But is there something going on there, do you think, with Roger Stone's role? Because that guy that has the InfoWars, that nutcase, he says that he was given $500,000 by the Trump campaign to help organize the storming of the Capitol, and that Roger Stone, he worked with Roger Stone on it. So already Alex Jones has suggested that he and Roger Stone have somehow planned the assault on the Capitol. Is there anything you know about the connections between these militias and Stone and planning the insurrection?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, we know that Roger Stone has used fairly routinely these types of brown shirts, if you will, for his security at various times. And one of the folks, at least, that was doing his security earlier in the day entered the Capitol. We knew that Rhodes was outside. We were also hearing information about groups storing weapons in the suburbs at a suburban hotel. So there's all kinds of intrigue. Here's what I think we're going to see. And that is, whatever is being speculated or even alleged is going to be reinforced when we have this guy Schaefer, the guy with the gray goatee, the rock guitarist, heavy metal guy, who was a co-founder. The fact that his announcement of flipping came on Friday, that's something. And I think what you're going to find is that this was more organized than we previously thought. The interesting issue is about the funding, and I want to see where that goes. Like they said in Watergate, right? Follow the money. I want to see more of that, and the prosecution now is going to be playing things close to the vest in the run-up to having these charges. They're going to try and get as many little herrings in there before they go for the big fish. So these allegations, one quick thing, are going to be easy to corroborate through financial transactions as well as the testimony of folks who flipped or who are going to flip.
Well, my understanding is that Rebecca Mercer, the daughter of Robert Mercer, who was a big funder of Trump and right-wing causes, and he's one of these billionaires who wants to play cop. He actually, believe it or not, he's made himself or bought himself a position as a deputy sheriff down in New Mexico, where he has a huge property, and he gets to play cop. But she, his daughter, they're obviously incredibly wealthy, she apparently funded a lot of the hotel and the buses that took these people to Washington.
Right, but the question is going to be, what did she know? There were a lot of people who were in the Stop the Steal movement who wanted to vent as opposed to premeditate beforehand like the Oath Keepers did. And then there are some who are maybe in between, right? So what's going to be interesting is exactly what is that connection? What did she know? What did she fund? And how many of these folks were taking advantage? In any event, I wouldn't want to be her today, because to the extent that you have a bad guy, any of their interactions and financial transactions are going to be looked at. So I would imagine she'd be lawyering up right now, not necessarily because she has any criminal culpability. We don't know that. Don't want to defame anybody. But this is something that is very close with respect to who came to Washington and what they did. So if I were someone in that situation, I would want to make sure that my story is pretty much firmed up, because anytime you're connected, even if you're connected tangentially or unknowingly, you're going to come up in an investigation of this magnitude.
Well, just in the last minute, Brian Levin, do you think that efforts on the part of Tucker Carlson, who said, oh, there were no guns, these people were peaceful, Trump said there was zero threat on January the 6th, and that the people that stormed the Capitol actually were kissing and hugging police. I mean, unbelievable rewriting of history is going on. And of course, a lot of supporters on the right of Trump and of these militias say, oh, it was really Antifa. So will there be some clarity here once you start trying and convicting these people? We all saw it with our own eyes what happened, let's face it. But are we going to be in a position where most of the country accepts the reality of what happened and we see justice in this case?
I think we are going to see justice, and I think we're going to see a record. And let me just thank you, by the way. You've been on this, and I appreciate it, and you've always let me have an unfettered access to the American public. And I want to tell you something. You made a statement. They were not only rewriting history, they were trying to rewrite contemporary events, because over the last several years during the Trump administration, at every turn, and I sent a statement to Congress last fall about this, there was an aggressive effort to purposely downplay at the highest level the threat of far-right white supremacist extremism, and not distribute products and analysis within the government at a time when our center was finding this, and so were our colleagues. So not only are they trying to rewrite history, they were trying to rewrite the docket at the time. And I want to thank you. That testimony is up on our website. In fact, I'll put it up on our Twitter at Prof Levin. Go look it up. You'll see the testimony. There was a cover-up.
Well, Brian Levin, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I'm speaking with Brian Levin, who's a criminologist, civil rights attorney, professor of criminal justice, and director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University, San Bernardino, where he specializes in analysis of hate crime, terrorism, and legal issues. Previously, Professor Levin served as an associate director of legal affairs of the Southern Poverty Law Center's Klan Watch Militia Task Force in Montgomery, Alabama, and he's testified before Congress's Homeland Security Subcommittee on Counterterrorism and Intelligence. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back discussing the paralysis at the United Nations, where China and Russia have been blocking efforts to stop the slaughter of civilians in Ethiopia and to get aid into a country that appears to be breaking apart.
I don't want to set the world on fire. I just want to start a flame in your heart. In my heart, I have...
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Ambassador Fesahat Esamah, who is a Tigrayan career diplomat who previously served as Ethiopia's ambassador to the United Nations as well as ambassador to Israel. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ambassador Fesahat Esamah.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us. And it does seem that at the United Nations where you served, the Security Council has not done anything about the ongoing murders and massacres in Ethiopia. that have been going on, not just in Tigray, but now even in other provinces. We're getting reports that there are massacres underway. So what is going on at the level of the Security Council? My understanding is that Russia and China are preventing efforts on the part of humanitarian groups and NGOs to try and stop this slaughter.
Thank you very much. It's unfortunate. It is true, the United Nations Security Council that has the full responsibility to deal with this kind of conflict where hundreds of thousands are being starving to death, on the verge of death. Tens of thousands, close to 70,000 are now in Sudan. There is horrendous, horrendous sexual violence. Young girls, including nuns, are being raped by both the Eritrean army, the Ethiopian army, the Amhara militia. And it is there on the international arena in terms of reporting it. What has happened at the Security Council is they have not yet even addressed the issue on a formal setting. They put the agenda of Tigray under any other agenda for 5 times, including this last week. And to our disappointment and to the disappointment of all humanitarian agencies, human rights organizations, they haven't done anything. As we speak today, there is a draft statement just simply to indicate their collective will to address what already both governments have acknowledged, the withdrawal of the Eritrean troops, the investigation of this genocide that's going on, and also access and delivery of humanitarian assistance to the millions of people in Tigray. It is still there. As we speak, the deadline is being pushed from noon to 3 p.m. to 6 p.m. because, as you mentioned earlier, for things that have nothing to do with the people of Tigray, simply because of their geopolitical interest, China and Russia continue to resist, simply to pronounce themselves on the Security Council agenda of Tigray. It is unfortunate, but it's happening.
So what happened between the current leader of Ethiopia, who's waging this war against Tigrayans, and the Tigray People's Liberation Front, which is headed by Mr. Debretsion, who was a former friend of Prime Minister Abiy. So is this a falling out between two people that's resulted in massacres? I mean, how do you explain what's going on here? Because the way that's been reported is that it was the Tigrayan leaders who broke off from Ethiopia that provoked this battle.
Yeah, that is what the narrative went on when Tigray was completely blocked from any media, both domestic, international, for over 3 months. And so only what the international community, international media heard was that the Tigrayan forces did take action against the central government. They had to be responsible. They are a disenchanted group. And may I also remind you that Abiy has been telling the international community there was no single soldier in Tigray for over 4 months. And this is one of the lies that he has delivered to the international community. What has happened is, it's not a personality clash. It has nothing to do with Abiy and Debretsion. They were in the same party. Yes, after a change of in 2018, something arose in Ethiopia in terms of political difference, like anywhere else. Two visions of where Ethiopia should be heading. We have tried kings and queens in Ethiopia. We were under Imperial Haile Selassie and kings before him. And then we had a brutal military communist government led by Mengistu. 1991, we had a new set of arrangements. Ethiopia is a country of extremely divergent groups, over 80 different ethnic groups, nationalities, as we call them, with different languages, a multitude of cultures and religion. So we thought all Ethiopians should feel they are part of the Ethiopian entity. So we have an arrangement of a federal arrangement with all its shortcomings. We gave it a try. It was working. And the symptoms, the reason it was working was Ethiopia was at peace with itself, with neighbors. It became the number one peacekeeping contributing from Africa, the second largest in the world. It has a double-digit economy growing for over 15 years. Then Abiy came, and even though he came from the same ruling party, he has other agendas. He wanted to send us back to a very strong unitary state dominated by one ethnic group in the country. That claims that it is a super group that should rule the country. And this is the Amhara elite. Therefore, he made an alliance with them, and to accomplish his mission, completely to destroy the Tigray entity as people, as political party, he made a deal with Isaias Afwerki. And the international community was duped, and he was given the Nobel Peace Prize. Little does the international community know, this was an alliance of two evils. Isaias, as you may know, a person who has been there for 50 years, 30 years as the head of government, another 25 years as the head of a guerrilla movement, single-handedly destroying Eritrea. And both of them tell us they are in Tigray to enforce law and order. And until about 3 weeks ago, they both denied they were in Tigray. And now they are changing uniforms and what have you to hoodwink the international community just to tell us that they are withdrawing. Among all these things, all the atrocities happening, as you know, the United States have pronounced itself, rightly so. The European Union even have gone as far as taking some financial restrictions, but nothing that will bring a difference on the ground because the Security Council is playing the same game. I was at the United Nations for many, many years, over 12 years all in all, and I have saw it when it happened in the former Yugoslavia, in Serbia, Herzegovina. I saw it when it happened in Syria, what have you, in Rwanda. Unfortunately, we thought the United Nations Security Council have told us it will never happen again, but it's happening to Ethiopia right now. They are failing us. It isn't their conscience, and people are dying every day.
And again, I'm speaking with Ambassador Fesaha Tesema, who is a Tigrayan career diplomat who previously served as Ethiopia's ambassador to the United Nations, as well as ambassador to Israel. So, but Prime Minister Abiy, he got the Nobel Peace Prize for ending the war with Eritrea, but it seems as though he is now using Eritrean forces to do attacks and massacres in Tigray, because they're right across the border. And there was a massacre of a religious community quite recently that was quite disgraceful and horrific. So what's going on there? I mean, are the Eritreans in your country, or have they withdrawn? And clearly, let me ask you this. Is Abiy using the Eritreans as proxies?
Yes, he is. In fact, he has told so many international interlocutors that his survival depends on the Eritrean army. He has told this to many diplomats in Addis and those that are traveling to Ethiopia. The paradox is when we have no war, no peace with Eritrea for 20 years. It is through 1998, Isaias invaded Tigray, which is the border to Eritrea, and he was defeated, humiliated. The whole army was about to raise against him, but Ethiopia decided to give him a chance if he can leave us alone. It took him 20 plus years to get revenge against Tigray, because at that time, even though it was an Ethiopian army that defeated him, Ethiopia was being headed by a Tigrayan prime minister, the late Prime Minister Meles. Many of the veteran leaders in the army were Tigrayans. So he thinks it was their muscle, their thinking, their political and diplomatic power that put Isaias in a corner. Isaias has been categorized as the North Korea of Africa. He ruined his country. Almost all young people are either in the army by force or outside the country. That's all he was doing. So when Abiy came to power, paradoxically, it was the Tigray leaders, part of the coalition, who put the thing on the agenda to have another rapprochement with Eritrea and to be at itself, because we felt the Tigrayans will benefit from peaceful living across the border with Eritrea. And that's exactly what happened. But Abiy wants to send back Ethiopia to unilateral state. He has publicly professed in the parliament that his mother has told him he will be the seventh king of Ethiopia, and he believes that. And the Tigrayans, who has paid heavily to get rid of the Mengistu region in 1991, after 17 years of long armed struggle, they resisted that. They said, no, we are going to administer ourselves. Our autonomy should stay intact. In fact, they defied the postponement of the national elections, and they ran election on time, and Debrecen was elected president of the region. They ran the regional election. And then he declared on camera, on television, saying, if you ever run an election, you will be ruined, you will be attacked. It is unbelievable. This is the only country, the only government that has declared war, executed it because citizens went to the poll.
Well, and let's talk a little
bit. Understood by the international community. The only country. Usually, people are punished, parties are punished for not going to election. But the Tigrayans went, 3 million of them voted, and then 2 months exactly after they did, he opened war against them.
Well, it seems like, though, the Tigrayans are not the only province or state in Ethiopia that's having military actions and massacres. The Amhara state in Ethiopia now is under attack by a group called the Oromo Liberation Army. So, you know, what's going on here? It seems like it's not just Tigray, it's other parts of... Who is doing this attacking in terms of, are these states trying to secede from Ethiopia? And who are the Oromo Liberation Army?
Well, just to give you a picture of what happened in Ethiopia is, when Abiy came to power, there were opposition parties that were working peacefully within the constitution in the country. But there were also others who were being sponsored by Eritrea and others who were waging an armed war, but they were contained. In fact, they were not inside the country. So when Abiy came to power, he brought many of them back home, which we thought was a good progress, but without any transparent agreement. Many of them came with their arms, with their logistics, and they are stationed in many parts of the country. And they were supposed to be integrated with the national army, the police, to be trained. But then they realized Abiy was not keeping his word. Again, the power was going to be concentrated in certain groups, in certain centers. So they are defying him. The whole country is now in turmoil. The difference in Tigray is the region have a history of resistance. It has organized the leadership. It is almost all the leaders are veterans of the 17 years of struggle. It has a resistance, even though it is a 6 million population versus 110 plus the rest of the country. He has been able to neutralize the rest of the country before the war on Tigray, but he brought this huge army, the Amhara militia, the Eritreans, drones from UAE, because he knew the Tigrayans will not surrender that easily. Now the rest of the country is also in a turmoil. There is war with the border problem with Sudan. There is counter-claim and counter-claim. I cannot tell you who is killing who from my vantage point of view. There are armed groups, the Amharas and the Oromos, that he claims are his strong supporters, are now at each other's throat. The Amharas say there is an armed group that is killing Amharas. Amharas are dying. Oromos are dying. Benishangul Gumuz is a state of war, another state. The whole country is about to go berserk, unfortunately. Many are saying now, including the West, that Ethiopia may not survive as a country unless something is done. There is no such thing as secession war right now. But what they're saying is, if you continue to kill us, if you continue to bomb us, maybe you will see another option for our survival. In the case of Tigray, there is no representation in the central government. Abiy has completely cleansed the defense ministry, the intelligence, from any Tigrayan speaking. There are over 20,000 members of the army and security in camps, simply because they're suspect citizens.
We have run out of time, I'm afraid, Ambassador Fesehe Tesema. And I want to just add that Human Rights Watch has also been reporting on massacres by the Eritrean forces in the border town of Adwa, and Ethiopian forces executed four men in front of a Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders staff as well. So let's talk again here. And again, I've been speaking with Ambassador Fesehe Tesema, who is a Tigrayan career diplomat who previously served as Ethiopia's ambassador to the United Nations as well as ambassador to Israel. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon, and this program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can sign up for our email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you like this program, you can help us reach more listeners by taking a moment to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, iHeartRadio, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please do share the program with friends and family and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. And to help us sustain our mission and spread the word to keep us corporate-free and commercial-free, we have added a donate button. So if you're in a position to give support, please take a moment to visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.